I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Will Baltimore City do away with plastic shopping bags? Monday, the city council unexpectedly passed a ban after tossing out plans for a 5-cent surcharge on plastic bags. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake has said she will veto the bill as an anti-business measure. But should she, and is it? We'll talk about that this hour. Plus, the scrapping of an Eastern Shore land lease that sparked allegations of favoritism against the O'Malley administration. We'll discuss that, too, with WYPR's Fraser Smith. And one more item of interest, a look at the role slaves and free blacks in Maryland played in the War of 1812, including the story of an escaped slave from Prince George's County who died a hero. That's Midday Friday, after the news from NPR. And this is the Friday Midday Show, Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. And with me in Studio A for the hour, C. Fraser Smith, WYPR's senior news analyst and Daily Record columnist. Nice to have you along for this hour, Fraser.
Always a pleasure.
We've got a few things we're going to talk about. The out of nowhere plastic bag ban that the city council voted on Monday night, 11-1. Kind of shocking to a lot of people. The mayor says she's going to veto it as an anti-business measure. Our question is, how do you feel about this for our listeners here, especially in Baltimore City, because this applies only to Baltimore City so far? 410-662-8780. And I must say, the last couple of days, social media in the city has been buzzing with this comments on this. I've got so much feedback here on Facebook and Twitter and in emails at The Sun on this subject. I'm a little surprised. I mean, and then again, not surprised that people feel strongly about banning plastic bags. And my mail is running 9 to 1 in favor of what the city council did. What do you make, though, Fraser, of the mayor coming out and saying she's going to veto this right away as soon as she gets a chance to do that? You know, she's still feeling some heat because of the bottle tax that passed a couple of years ago and then was increased. You think that's what's going on there? Why would she be opposed to that?
Well, I haven't talked to her, but you would think that this would be an opportunity for her to make some points on the environmental front.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at a point in the Bay where the city of Baltimore makes its contribution. You know, it's not so much phosphorus in the fields and the chickens, but we've all seen pictures of the scoopers picking up all of this material that goes into the bay and into the inner harbor, which you would think one would want to keep as pristine as possible. And I think a lot of people understand what the importance of this is. I was telling you before, I live with somebody who walks down the street and picks up these bags when she sees them flying around because she's concerned about animal life in the water.
Right, right. And the plastic bags, we acknowledge, is just one piece of a big trash stream. Like, as Fraser says, ends up in the Jones Falls and ends up in the harbor. We see it here. We see it against chain link fences. We see it in trees. We see it in bushes. It's not just plastic bags, but it seems to me the plastic bags are one thing you can pull out of the trash stream with this measure. And the state of California has a statewide ban on plastic bags that the governor, Jerry Brown, just recently signed. I'm a little shocked by the idea of a statewide ban on plastic bags, but it's in the LA Times. I read it there. Chris McGarrian covers California government and politics for the LA Times. And he's written about California's ban on plastic bags and joins us here for a few minutes to talk about it. So, Chris McGarrian out at the LA Times, thank you very much for making time for us here on the Midday Show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm curious, how did this come about? This was passed by the legislature in California?
Right. So, this was one of several attempts by the legislature to ban plastic bags at grocery stores, pharmacies, liquor stores. But it's really been a long time coming. San Francisco's had its own citywide ban on plastic bags for several years now, and Los Angeles has its own ban. Other cities have put their own bans in place. So by the time the state did its own ban, you know, roughly one-third of all Californians were already living in places where there were local bag bans. So, you know, they really laid the groundwork for this before they went to the state level.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So, and what's the statewide support look like, Chris? The governor signed the bill, but do you have some polling on it?
Yes. Yeah, so right now, we recently did a poll with the University of Southern California, and it basically shows that support for the bag ban is very high, and that most Californians would vote against any effort to get rid of the bag ban. So right now, it's pretty solid.
What has been the argument for keeping plastic bags? I'm curious, because I've heard a few things just in the last three days, because of the city council here in Baltimore voting on it. It seemed like pretty flimsy arguments. The first one we heard here is, well, if you take away the plastic bags, you'll have to be more paper bags, and those are more expensive, and people will have to pay for those. Did you hear that in California?
Yeah, we definitely heard that, because part of the statewide ban includes a provision that would charge customers 10 cents per paper bag to offset that cost. And, you know, there were people who didn't like that, people who thought that would, you know, hurt, you know, consumers at the store. But, you know, that wasn't enough to stop the bill. You know, the big argument from the plastic bag manufacturers is that it's going to hurt jobs, that, you know, we're going to make less, you know, one-use plastic bags. Therefore, you know, we're not going to be able to employ as many people. But the bill does include some money to try to retool some of these factories to make reusable plastic bags. So some of that concern was mitigated, although not enough to satisfy the manufacturers.
Right. So plastic bags of a quality that you can reuse them several times. Chris, this is Fraser Smith in the studio with me. Go ahead, Fraser.
Chris, what did the scientists say? Were they helpful to the governor and to local officials?
The science on it.
Definitely the environmentalists were the driving force behind pushing this statewide ban, talking about the pollution that the plastic bags cause and things like that. But I would say, you know, from a political angle, what really helped.
Oh, my goodness. We lost Chris McGarian. Chris McGarian from the L.A. Times. Have no idea what happened there. Just the phone call dropped. And very, very sorry about that. Maybe we can get Chris back for a few minutes. Wanted to spend some time on this, and then we have a couple other subjects to tackle in this hour of midday Friday. So feel free to phone in and tell us what you think here. 410-662-8780. Maybe the lesson from California. If anybody's thinking beyond Baltimore City, maybe the state of Maryland should move here and ban plastic bags. Fraser, we are on the Chesapeake Bay. We are environmental sensitivity very keen in our state. So start at the local level, right? Get local jurisdictions, get people into the swing of this locally, and then it won't be a big shock if you try it on the state level.
Well, I think people are aware of the fact that there are multiple sources of pollution in the Bay. I mean, it's been reported on, particularly focusing on the chicken farmers, because of the effect that pollution has on the water quality and on plant life and you know, creating dead zones and all the kinds of things that have happened that Rona knows a lot more about, Dan, than you all have talked about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think that at some point people would realize that they need to be involved in this. I mean, a lot of people recycle. I mean, so, you know, the knowledge base is out there. So you would think that it's not something that would offend a lot of people if you know, and the costs don't seem to be that great.
No. Hey, Chris, you're back with us. Chris McGarian.
Yes, back here now. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks a lot. I was just saying to Fraser that I guess from what you're telling us, the lesson here is if you're going to start a statewide movement to ban this form of plastic, this source of litter, start at the local level. Get some jurisdictions to enact it first and then move to the legislature.
Right. And obviously, you know, there are a lot of very liberal cities in California that are very amenable to these types of things, these types of environmental regulations. And that created enough momentum to really get it to the statewide level.
Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, nice to hear from you. Chris McGarian, who covers California government and politics for the LA Times. And we posted a story that he wrote about the ban that went into effect there, plastic ban at the state level, a plastic bag ban at the state level that Governor Brown in California signed. Fraser, let's take a couple calls on this, because the first opportunity we had on midday, anyway, to hear from folks, although I've been hearing about this all week at The Sun and online. Jan in Baltimore. Jan, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi, everyone. I am so totally in support of banning plastic shopping bags completely. However, I always put my trash out in a kitchen bag, a plastic kitchen bag. Makes it easier for the garbage people to pick it up and haul it away. And sometimes, I mean, if you're wealthy, you can buy a plastic biodegradable bag.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I wanted to mention that the government of Bhutan banned plastic bags about 20 years ago. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Yeah, Jan. Yeah, Fraser, I've been hearing this all week from people who've spent time in Europe, lived in Europe, and said, you know, you just don't get a bag at a store in Germany. You have to maybe ask for it. I don't even know if you get one, but just people are in the habit of bringing their own reusable bags to the store with them. Speaking of reusable bags, a couple of emails came in here. Who wrote to me on this? Oh, this was Andrew. Andrew, I wanted to read Andrew's letter. He's talking about the Save-A-Lot on Pennsylvania Avenue. Save-A-Lot has two sizes of plastic bags and will sell the customer as many bags as needed. These bags cost 5 or 10 cents, depending on the size. These are sturdy, thick, and very reusable bags. I am a people watcher, and more than 95% of the shoppers purchased 3 to 5 bags each. This cost does not deter the purchase of the bags. This cost is not a bag tax. This cost does not seem to elicit scorn from the shoppers. This cost does not seem to encourage bag reuse either. Is this a cultural or educational thing or just an I don't care attitude? The other thing I've noticed is that in convenience stores, the plastic bag for even the purchase of the smallest item becomes the receipt, so to speak. It shows that I paid for this. I'm not shoplifting. Anyway, that's from Andrew on Pennsylvania Avenue. But his point about those heavier duty plastic bags, even when you charge people for those, they don't reuse them. So he's actually saying later in the letter, just do away with plastic bags and let people cope, let people adapt.
Do you think we're talking about convenience here for people? You know, you don't always
have habit. They just expect it to be there.
Well, you don't always have your market bag with you if you're out walking around somewhere. If you don't have your car. So
I've always wondered about this, though. If you knew that there was no chance of having a plastic bag in the store, does it get into your head? Hey, I'm going shopping now, or I'm driving around in my car, and I got to keep a few of these bags here because I'm going to have to stop and get some groceries on the way home from work. I mean, doesn't it get in your head?
Well, you know, one of the other arguments I think ought to be is that they're ugly.
The
plastic bags are ugly. I mean, they're handy, but, you know, and they litter. You see them all over. They blow in the wind.
And by cracky
like leaves.
By cracky, Fraser, you and I are old enough to remember when these things didn't exist.
We are. Admit it.
Yeah, Chris McGarian sounded a little young there. I was going to say to him, do you remember when there were these plastic bags did not exist, and then suddenly they were everywhere? Let's take another call. Tom in Baltimore, who can think back at least 25 years. Hello, Tom.
Guys. How are you doing today?
Good.
And I'm sure you guys will recall, I want to talk to you about what you just mentioned. About 35, 40 years ago, everybody used plastic bags, paper bags.
Right.
Then the city government decided that paper bags were ruining all the trees.
Or we were sacrificing trees to make paper, right?
So they said that you have to go to plastic. And they said that if you don't use plastic, we're going to charge you a nickel for every paper bag you use. So they're doing the same thing now.
Okay, but they're not actually charging anything. The city's not doing it. The stores would be doing it.
You had a choice between paper and plastic about 30 years ago when they changed.
I remember.
And they said, well, if you want paper, you got to pay for it. So it was a nickel bag. So now they're doing the same thing. They forced plastic. The government forced plastic on the people. And now they want to change their mind again. So I feel like I'm on a yo-yo or something.
Yeah, well, things come and go, right? I mean, we've seen the results of this. Maybe there has been convenience, but when you, in the equation, you add in the litter that's come from it. I mean, that's why we're talking about this, right?
We're talking about pollution. We're talking about cleaning up the water.
That's why we talk about
so you could fish
bag.
In it, so there would actually be fish there.
Right. A short break. We'll come back and take some more phone calls. This is Midday Friday. Dan Rodrigues here with Fraser Smith. We also want to talk about the almost land lease deal that the O'Malley administration had proposed that was scrapped the other day that Comptroller Peter Franchot called sleazy. We have that for you. And then a bit of War of 1812 history, the role that free slaves and blacks played in the War of 1812 here in the Baltimore area and in Maryland. We'll get to that later in the hour. Did he say chili today? Actually, we're having pizza. Friday lunch is delivered by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Thank you, Joe Squared, for the pizza every Friday here in the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks with C. Fraser Smith, WIPR Senior News Analyst. Another email, this one from Rosemary. At Price Right, the plastic bags are 11 cents. I bought some salad fixings the first time I went there. The cashier said, "Do you want a bag?" I said, "Yes." She told me it was 11 cents. I carried my three items out in my arms. Now I keep several reusable bags in my car trunk. Thank you very much. Bob writes in to say, the ban just gives me one more opportunity to use my brand new NPR tote bag. I'm sorry, Fraser. People are into this. Eileen in Baltimore says, I would definitely support a Maryland bag ban. She says, Sam's Club, Costco, Aldi's, and others do not supply bags, but they have cardboard boxes available. And let's see, Jen in Govins says, I recently received notices from both Giant and ShopRite that they are discontinuing their 5-cent refund for bringing reusable bags to the stores. I am worried that ending these promotions will increase the use of plastic bags in the area. Yeah, Jen, I noted the same thing. Giant, they sent out a letter, and they offered you a coupon for a free reusable bag. And I noted that in my column the other day, and I wonder, are things that tight with supermarkets? You can't give me 5 cents for bringing my reusable bags? And the message from the president of the company seemed to be, Gordon Reed, the president of the Giant, seemed to be, well, people got this figured out now. People are environmentally sensitive now, so we don't need to provide this incentive anymore. Fraser.
Well, they can learn to be sensitive if they're actually not. You know what it reminds me of, Dan? The struggle over many years to get seatbelts enacted in Maryland. Mm-hmm. Whenever you legislate something, and the mayor should know this, she probably does, that intrudes in your personal space, so to speak, then you have a problem politically.
Right.
People just, it's sort of like getting an increase in your utility bill. You see it right there in front of you. It comes in the mail.
Sure.
You know, you get in the car. You don't want it. Some people don't want to put on their seatbelt. Of course they should, and everybody ought to use paper bags or carry their bags so they save the bay.
Yeah. And, I compared it to recycling. Remember when recycling started? Well, a lot of people thought that was nanny state stuff, the overreach of government. It seemed like a big pain in the neck to people to separate out the plastics and paper, but people got used to that. People figured that out.
I don't want to take things too far, Dan, of course, but there's something called the community, and we ought to be attuned to that. I mean, you see it in Obamacare. You can't have an insurance program if you don't have a big pool, if people don't get involved in it.
Let's go to the phone lines again. Dan Rodericks here with Fraser Smith. Carol and Glenn Burney, you're on Midday. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, Carol, can you hear us okay?
Yes.
All right, go right ahead.
Okay. I remember a few years ago, I pulled into a parking lot down here in Glen Burnie, and as I was getting ready to go into a store, I heard this commotion, and when I turned around, there was a seagull frantically trying to fly around the parking lot with this plastic bag wrapped around its leg.
Wow. Yeah.
And every time it tried to take off, of course, the bag twisted tighter. Jeez. So I had a thick pair of gardening gloves in the back of the car along with a blanket, and I grabbed them both, and I headed toward the gull to try to put the blanket over it when this gentleman from a car lot across the street came over. And between the two of us, we were able to pin the bird down. And the bag was twisted so tightly around its leg that it had embedded itself into the leg. And it took us quite a while.
Wow.
And we were all three exhausted, but we were able to get the bag off. And then the bird was able to fly away. But he had a pretty nasty wound on his leg.
It sounds like the plastic had been on his leg for a while then. have been.
It does.
Yeah. Carol, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that story. That's one of the reasons why we're talking about this today. Thank you very much for that call. Toby in Baltimore, we'll take yours next. Welcome to Midday. Toby, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because it just seems to me that the mayor is more concerned with upsetting her constituents and keeping her votes rather than actually facing the facts and acknowledging that the plastic bags and that float around the city are costing the taxpayers more money than what they realize.
Yeah. The mayor has been beat up over the bottle tax the last few years. The bottle tax was implemented, then it was increased. And she got this label by some as being anti-business. So I'm not surprised when this came along, maybe she said, a week after the election, when the man she supported did not win, Anthony Brown, maybe she's thinking, I better chill on this. And plus, the city council kind of got the jump on her on it, right? I mean, this came out of the city council. The city council looks like they're in the lead on this one.
Yeah, you don't want that.
You don't want the city council getting out of it. Yeah, mayors aren't used to that in Baltimore.
No, not at all.
Multiple mayors. Courtney in Baltimore County, you're on Midday. Hi.
Hi, I'm calling because I would also really support even like a full state ban on plastic bags. I just wanted to share that I was living in California at the time that my town banned plastic bags. And while I knew that, of course, it would be better to bring my reusable bags, I did not do that regularly until the ban went into place. And it wasn't even exactly the 10-cent charge of the bag, because even if you buy 10 bags with the groceries, which is a lot, that's a dollar. But just the having to do that was a reminder to where I got in the habit of bringing my bags with me every time. And then I moved here and I just stopped, it seems dumb. Like I should be able to do that, but having the encouragement of the ban really helped.
Well, maybe you got to get something started in Baltimore County. Huh? Yeah,
for sure.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. Lots of comments on Facebook on this topic. If you want to go to the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page and read some more of those, we can continue to take calls about this subject. But I just want to turn to another story this week, Frazier, and get your comment on it. And I see we have a caller who wanted to say something about this. This kind of popped up out of nowhere on the front page of the Baltimore Sun the other day, Michael Dresser's story about the O'Malley administration proposing a land deal, under which the state would buy a 255-acre farm in the town of Millington over on the eastern shore. I believe that's Kent County. Yeah, Kent County. We're going to pay $2.8 million for this. That's money out of the program Open Space, a very good program in Maryland. But they were going to turn around and lease this land for a dollar a year to the Eastern Shore Food Hub Corporation. That nonprofit is controlled by one Cleo Braver, a Talbot County organic farmer who has contributed more than $40,000 to Democratic candidates over the past decade, quoting here from the Sun story. So then we get to the Board of Public Works in Maryland that consists of the governor of Maryland, the treasurer, Nancy Kopp, and the comptroller, Peter Franchot. The board's vote, 2-1, means that the state will take the title to the farm under the program Open Space. So they are going to buy the land, but the lease deal is off the table. Peter Franchot, the state comptroller, called the lease deal, without any competitive bidding, sleazy. So you saw this story this week. What did you make of that?
Well, almost by definition, it has a sleaze factor. If you do it without a competitive bidding, why would they do such a thing? And then, of course, that opens the conversation totally to the question of whether there's some favoritism going on. And then, of course, people check out to see whether the recipient of the deal made contributions politically in Maryland. And so you get a story that you think people would be sensitive, particularly political people, wouldn't want to read about this on page one of the Baltimore Sun or the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And yet it does happen all the time.
So what are they thinking story?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that the thinking is this is well-meaning because, this organization is a nonprofit. They're going to set up this food distribution hub over in the Eastern Shore so that people can access locally grown food. It all looks good, but even if it is an organic farmer, somebody who's given $40,000 to Democratic candidates over 10 years is, a player. Somebody who's, may not sound like a lot of money, but it's money.
Exactly. But, and who knows who else might want to compete for this?
Exactly.
And so that's really where the favor comes. It's not so much the money, I think. As you point out, it's not that much.
So please understand, so I made it clear there, they did go ahead and purchase the land. It's the lease deal that is off the table now, has been scrapped. Your comments on that are welcome. Now, Jay is calling from Millington. And Jay, so please identify yourself. Would you please? Jay is the executive director of a conservation association. What's your last name, Jay?
My last name's Falstead, and I'm the executive director of Queen Anne's Conservation Association, and I live on the Millington side of Queen Anne's County.
Okay, so Millington sounds like it's right there at the border of Queen Anne's and Kent?
It is. It's right on the line.
Give us your view of this.
Well, the reason I'm calling is the parcel itself is actually very unique, and so I'm glad that the state was able to authorize the purchase. In this particular area of the Eastern Shore, there is no public land in a park-type way that allows people to get out and enjoy nature in the way that you would have hiking trails and that sort of thing. And this particular parcel has two mill ponds. It's got woods at 278 acres. It's a large parcel. And given that it's right next to the town, I think will provide not only the town with some unique opportunities to bring in more people. And so from that perspective, I think it's a good purchase. What I think had everybody upset about this was the lease agreement. And the lease agreement by itself really would have violated the spirit of Program Open Space. If you look at the statute of Program Open Space, it very clearly says that that money is to be used for the benefit of the public. And that lease agreement, as it was outlined, would have just completely undermined, in my view, the intent of Program Open Space.
By the way, Jay, I'm glad you called in. Do you have it at 278 acres?
I think it's 275.
275. Okay, because the Sun had it at 255. But nonetheless, do you think that's a good deal then, $2.8 million for that?
Well, the purchase price is certainly a premium. Agricultural lands over here are generally under $10,000 per acre. And so the state, in my view, did pay a little bit more for this property, but it does have some ecological benefit. As I understand it from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, this parcel did score high on an ecological scale that they use. And that may be because it has the two mill ponds and may have some unique species in the area. And so it's not out of the question to have paid that much. It is a little bit of a premium. But in the end, I think this was a good purchase. There's a public school nearby, and I'd like to think that school kids will have the opportunity to walk in this area once it's got trails constructed in it. And it will ultimately be good for public use. So from that perspective, I'm glad they made the purchase.
Okay. I'm with you on this, and Fraser probably is too. And what we're wondering is the next step. Like, as Fraser said, perhaps others are interested on bidding for the use of this land or part of the use of the land. So, Jay Falstead, what about that aspect of it? Do we actually need to lease this land to somebody? What do you think of that? I mean, can it just be open space?
I question whether this can even be allowed under Program Open Space to be open to competitive bidding in the way that they've talked about.
Oh, I see.
As I say, Program Open Space, if you look on the Maryland Department of Natural Resources website, has some specifics on what that money can be used for, and it's meant to be used for parks and to create public enjoyment for the benefit of the public. I think if this is opened up to competitive bidding and used for a food hub or an organic farm or whatever the case might be, that begins to violate the spirit of program open speech.
Oh, I get you. I'm glad you restated that. Thank you very much. It's Jay Falstead again. What's the name of your organization?
And I'm with Queen Anne's Conservation Association, and our website is www.qaca.org.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. I found that informative. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you.
You know, he does raise this other question about can you even use land purchased under program open space for such a purpose? In this case, a food hub for distributing. Actually, the group that was supposed to get this lease wants to have this food hub for distributing locally grown products.
Are we talking about a warehouse, do you think, where people would bring in the food and sell it?
You know, it's not clear to me without quickly reading this again what the intent was there for this lease. So anyway, maybe it was supposed to be a farm to produce food. I don't know. But I did look into program open space last year sometime to see, how it was doing and what the law actually says. And he's correct about what it says. I remember reading that. Some of the money is supposed to go to, I think, can go to playgrounds, parks, and recreation as well. It's supposed to be open to the public. So anyway, so Governor O'Malley, that photograph of Governor O'Malley, did you see him sitting at the Board of Public Works? He looked kind of bored and distant a little bit. Maybe they just caught him at that moment when he was gazing off into space. But he didn't seem to be too happy about what went down here. And the
he made
controller.
A snarky comment about what the new administration would likely do in the area of open space. You know, he said something. It's not as if, you know, the new governor is going to be really very concerned about open space.
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen, doesn't it?
Certainly does.
How do we know?
It may be very much in favor of it.
And one last question for you today. What did you think of Larry Hogan saying that he wasn't going to really announce any policy plans until after his inauguration?
I think it is a declaration that will not stand. I think you can't have 2 months of a complete lid on. People are going to find out what they have in mind. And believe me, the political world, Democrat and Republican, is in turmoil right now. Nobody knows who to call. And so nobody has any information. But, you know, eventually you can see some of the things that seem to be about to happen. I mean, he'll make them official when he... And you can understand why he doesn't want to talk until he knows what he's talking about. It makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. But we're used to hearing some things, though. December headed to January, certainly headed toward inauguration.
Well, and people know already that he's going to hire a lot of people for his administration who, for example, are currently employed by the state of Maryland in the legislature, because that's where a lot of the Republican talent is. Right. So, you know, there are things going on, and I don't think he's going to be able to, as I said, keep the lid on.
Frazier, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure, Dan.
Frazier Smith, the senior news analyst here at WYPR, joining us here in the midday show in this hour. We're going to take a break here. When we get back, we got some history for you. We'll hear about free blacks and slaves during the War of 1812, including the story of an escaped slave from Prince George's County, ran away to Baltimore, enlisted with an infantry regiment. A historian, Ralph Eshelman, will be joining us after this short break. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here now with a bit of history for you. You know, in September, we made a big deal about the 200th anniversary of the writing of the National Anthem by Francis Scott Key during the War of 1812. So we wanted to follow up today a little bit on the War of 1812 because it's still 200 years ago. Ralph Eshelman is here, historian, co-author of several books, actually, on the War of 1812. The one I'll mention here is In Full Glory Reflected, Discovering the War of 1812 in the Chesapeake. Ralph, it's nice to have you with us. Ralph Eshelman.
Happy to be here.
And Ralph, you really focused on the history of the Chesapeake and particularly the war. Am I right? You have 5 books on just on the war.
I enjoyed every one of them.
Well, thank you for being here. Because one of the things that was brought to our attention, a sort of overlooked piece of history when it comes to the War of 1812, and that is freed blacks and slaves in Maryland during that time. And tomorrow in Baltimore, there's a symposium, actually, on the War of 1812 called The Summation that the Creative Alliance is putting on. We'll tell people about that in a minute, but that occasions your visit here with us today. So I'm very interested in this. So what if I have a list of names here. What if I give you these names, and you tell us a little bit about these individuals.
Sure.
Would that be all right? The one I'm curious about right off the bat is William Williams. This is the slave I mentioned from Prince George's County. Why don't we start with him?
Well, he's actually my favorite, and his real name was Frederick Hall. And he was a slave on a plantation that was known as Belfields. And the name of his master was Colonel Benjamin Odin. And this slave escaped. And what's unique about him is that when most slaves in the Chesapeake escaped, they went to the British side. And the reason for it is the British offered them freedom, offered them clothing, offered them food, offered them shelter, and also allowed them to bring their family, their immediate family. And this guy did not do that. Now, we don't know why.
So he really is unique if the other slaves were going to the British.
We think that maybe he was fearful because a lot of the slave owners would spread rumors about the atrocities that the British might put upon these slaves, that they really weren't going to get their freedom. And you can understand why stories like that would get circulated.
Sure.
But instead, this guy goes to Baltimore. And apparently he had some friends there. And if you read the descriptions, he was light-complected. He even had freckles. And so he apparently was able to get by in some instances by almost acting as if he was a white and not necessarily a black man. But most certainly he also tried to act like a free black, meaning that he was not a slave.
Were there a lot of freed blacks in Baltimore at that time? Because we know that by the Civil War, I think historians say that by the Civil War, there were more freed blacks in Baltimore than anywhere.
I don't know about that, but there was a large number.
Okay.
During the War of 1812, the population of Baltimore was about 50,000 people, and 20% of them were blacks. And when I say black, I mean free black or slave. That's a very large percentage. So you're talking around 10,000 people. So this guy could blend in with them. But the amazing thing is that he goes and joins the 38th Regiment of the U.S. Army.
Are they at Fort McHenry?
They get stationed at Fort McHenry. During the bombardment, he is present.
Is his name by then William Williams?
Yes, he changed his name, and you can understand why he would do that. He was fearful of potentially getting recaptured. So he changed his name to William Williams. He is now in the U.S. Army, and he's stationed in the dry moat on the opposite side of the water at Fort McHenry. And the reason for that is that if you could imagine these bombs and rockets being fired by the British, that moat up against the wall on the far side of the fort was actually the most protected area. Unfortunately for this guy, one of the bombs comes down and explodes near him. He is wounded in the leg, and ultimately he's taken to the public hospital. His leg is amputated, and then he dies several days later, probably from infection, which was very common in those days. But the best part of the story, other than the fact that here's a black man who escapes and gives his life for a country that held him captive, here's the most remarkable part. His former owner now tries to go to court to get what is known as the land bounty. And for your listeners who may not understand that, if you enlisted in the Army and even in the militia, you oftentimes were given what was known as a cash bonus or a money bonus, actually known as a bounty. And that was an encouragement for you to sign up. And then if you did well, you didn't commit anything that was against the law, you served honorably, you're discharged, or you get killed, you then were also given what is known as a land bounty. And this would be land, typically in Maryland, it would be in Western Maryland, as you might imagine.
So let me guess, William Williams' master tries to claim that?
Exactly. Wow. And it goes to court, and the judgment is very interesting because the judgment said that Odin didn't do enough to try to find his slave, to get him back. So because he did not do due diligence to get this guy back, the land bounty is given to the former slave's family. And so in the end, I think it's really great that this happened. I'm just kind of maybe disappointed in
the reasoning for it. Yeah.
Yes.
It's the right result,
yes.
Wrong reasoning.
Yes.
For William Williams.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad we got to talk about him today. That's a really interesting story, a sad story. But, you know, I'm struck by what you said about the other slaves. I mean, it does make sense to me that they would try to join up with the British, because they didn't know this country was keeping them enslaved, right? And the British were making promises. So do we know that some slaves that got away went with the British and actually fought with the British?
Oh, yeah.
They did.
That's even another amazing story. No one knows exactly how many did this, but we're talking about several thousand in the Chesapeake are escaped slaves and end up now in British hands. What is England going to do with all these people? And so Tangier Island, which I hope most of your listeners is aware of, it's an island kind of down in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, they actually built barracks there to house these slaves because they made a promise to them. Why would the English do that? Why would they go to these expense? And think of the obligation to feed and shelter all these people. And they were doing it because this war in the Chesapeake was as much an economic war as it was a military war. And if you wanted to really hurt the economy of the Chesapeake, you wanted to hit tobacco. That's the money crop. Mm-hmm. So whenever they did a raid, they would take the tobacco and the hogsheads and oftentimes take it back to England because it was a worthwhile endeavor. You could make money on this. Or if they couldn't do that, they would burn it. Well, this hurt the economy. But the British were smart that they understood that, okay, if we take the tobacco, that's going to hurt maybe for a year. But then they're going to be able to replant. They're going to get that crop back the following year.
But they'll need slaves for that.
If you take the labor force, mm-hmm. and tobacco is a very, very heavy labor-intensive product to grow, then what is the plantation owner going to be? And just to give you an example, Soderley Plantation, which is...
We talked about that recently, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. that's in St. Mary's County, yeah. on the Patuxent River. Mm-hmm. And that's a plantation where they had 58 slaves, 49 of whom escaped to the British side. Think what that did to the economy of Soderley Plantation. It was a tremendous economic blow to them.
Let me mention, Ralph Eshelman, let me mention a couple other names. Let's hear from you on these. George Roberts.
George Roberts is another one of these interesting characters. He was a black man who ended up on a privateer. And he was one of the gunners.
That's like the Pride of Baltimore? A privateer, not a skipjack.
A privateer was a... There were many different types, yeah. but in our area, we typically referred to them as Baltimore Clippers.
Clippers, thank you very much.
So they were fast ships. They were very agile.
Right.
And the significance of a privateer is that you would get a commission from the American government to allow you to go and take ships of the country that you were at war with. And the reason that the United States would do this is because we didn't have much of a navy. So by privately commissioning these vessels to be able to do what they did, it was a way for us to harass British shipping. But in exchange to the privateer, they would have to pay import duties on what they captured. So the United States would make some money, the privateers would make some money, and it would upset the English.
Right.
I should also
point
out—
And enhance our navy, so to speak. Right?
Yes, absolutely. But I should also point out that England also outfitted privateers, as did some of the English colonies in what we call Canada today. So there were privateers, for example, coming out of Nova Scotia. So I don't want people to think that it's just the United States doing this. Both sides were doing it.
So George Roberts, who was a free black, right?
Yes.
Was he aboard one of these privateers?
He was on two different privateers. I don't remember the name of the first privateer, but when the war first started, he actually got captured and then eventually was released, came back, and went right back into the same profession. And now he's on board a privateer known as the Chasseur, which is really one of the more significant privateers that operated out of.
The Chasseur.
Chasseur, yes.
So, and he serves aboard that?
Yes, as a gunner. And the significance of this particular vessel is that, as you can imagine, a privateer would rarely ever want to go up against a British naval warship. That's not what you're out there for. You want to take another, let's say, merchant vessel that's lightly armed, relatively easy prey. What does the Chasseur do? It takes one of the British military vessels, known as the St. Lawrence, and this is in February of 1815, off the coast of Cuba. And so when it comes back in to Baltimore, it sails right past Fort McHenry. Fort McHenry fires a shot, as does the Chasseur. This is a salute to one another, welcoming one of their privateers back into the harbor. when they finally get to Baltimore and they announce how successful they had been, one of the local newspapers referred to the Chasseur as the pride of Baltimore. And so today...
Is that where the name comes from?
Yes.
Wow.
So the replicas that we have today, the original... And then unfortunately sunk, and then we now have the Pride of Baltimore too. They're named the Pride of Baltimore, which is named after the Chasseur.
Ralph, tell us about Charles Ball. This is a slave who escaped to Maryland from Georgia, right?
Yeah, you have all these great names that you're throwing at
Charles
me.
Ball.
Charles Ball, number one, he lived in Calvert County. So he was a Marylander who was captured and then taken into slavery down to the south, down into Georgia. And he escapes and he comes back up into the Chesapeake. And he also acts as if he's a free black. And here's another example, just like William Williams, where he now joins the U.S. Navy. And particularly, he joins what's known as the Chesapeake Flotilla, which is commanded by Joshua Barney, which is a fellow who was born and raised in Baltimore County, not far from where we are, Bear Creek, on the Patapsco Peninsula, who became really a naval hero during the War of 1812. The thing that's funny about Charles Ball, and I say funny because we don't really know his real name. He wrote a biography. He probably told somebody about these stories and someone else actually wrote it down for him. There's some people who believe it may be a compilation of many different stories by escaped slaves, and I won't go into the details, but there's some reasonings behind that. But in his narrative, he talks about fighting for Joshua Barney at the Battle of Bladensburg. And it's he that referred to the American first and second line, which were largely militia, being, they were redrawing so quickly, they were like dogs being chased.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, like sheep being chased
sheep
by
being
dogs.
Sheep being chased by dogs, yeah.
So
right.
This is where that little quote comes from. It comes from Charles Ball.
Thank you for those stories. Just quickly, Ralph, I don't have much more time left, but just wanted to ask you about this. You said there were about 50,000 people in Baltimore at the time of the War of 1812. 20% of them or so were...
Approximately 20% were
either
black.
Slaves or freed slaves.
Correct. Or free
or
blacks.
Servants or free blacks.
Yeah.
It just seems like there were a lot of soldiers here, too, right?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, the city must have been overwhelmed with military at that time.
When Baltimore was attacked, it's estimated that a minimum of about 15,000 militia came into the city. So imagine the additional people that were here.
That's a very high percentage, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did they feed and how did they take care of them?
It was very difficult. In fact, the rations, I don't have a long time to tell you about this, but there was one story of one of the units known as the Baltimore Defensibles who got spoiled meat as their ration.
Oh,
and in
great.
A protest, they did a funeral for it. They actually marched it up into a hole that they had dug, and they buried it in the ground in protest.
Ralph Eshelman, it's great to have you here. So are you going to be at the symposium tomorrow?
I will. I'll be there.
Boy, you really teased us. I'd like to know some more. If you want to know some more, so here's the deal tomorrow. The Creative Alliance, which is in the Old Patterson Theater at 3134 Eastern Avenue in Baltimore, they're having this symposium tomorrow, War of 1812 history, some of the overlooked history. It's called The Summation. Tickets are available at creativealliance.org. You can find a link to that on the Dan Rogers Facebook page. I also think we tweeted out information about that symposium tomorrow. There is a ticket charge for it. And Ralph will be there. Ralph is serving as moderator of a panel discussion.
That's correct.
Right? Do you know what time it starts, Ralph?
8:30 is kind of like pre-breakfast, and I think the first talks are at 9:15, something like that.
So it's all day, 8:30 to 5:30 p.m., it says. So if you want one more dose of War of 1812 history, that's where to get it tomorrow at the Creative Alliance. Ralph, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much for coming by.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the first hour of Midday. That's our first hour. We have a second hour coming up, all about food in the second hour, Midday Eats with Henry Hong and John Shields, plus Michael Ruhlman, the award-winning food writer, will be with us. And it's all about roasting. So if you're prepping for Thanksgiving and you need some pointers on technique roasting the big bird, stay tuned for the second hour of Midday. We'll enjoy some pizza right now from Joe Squared Pizza that provides it for our lunch every Friday here in the Midday Show. Please stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you for the second hour.